Lasso. This afternoon, I'd like to return to the second of the four immeasurables of compassion. We'll do this in a rather classic fashion. We might recall some of the wisdom of Buddhaghosa, that which directly catalyzes the arousal of compassion is witnessing or bringing to mind someone who is suffering and seeing that they're helpless, that they can't simply solve their own problem, which, relax, watch them do it, but they really are in need of help. Okay, that arouses this heart, this aspiration, the yearning of compassion. Very importantly, once again, compassion is an aspiration, not simply a feeling sorry for. But I think it was George, quite a few days ago, that made the comment that compassion, meditating compassion, might be, on occasion, a rather poor substitute for actually doing some good in the world. Didn't you say something of that sort? I think so. Yeah. I believe so. And that's a very good point. It's a very, very good point. And so we'll be practicing Donglen. We'll be engaging in an exercise of imagination, but designed to arouse the heart, to cultivate compassion. But I will quote my old friend, Matthieu Ricard, again in this regard, and that is this meditation. What's it good for? You're just sitting here and nobody's getting any benefit at all outside, as far as we know, unless it's on some very subtle plane. But the point of the practice is that it nurtures, it cultivates the heart so that we are poised, like a bird on a wire, ready to fly. The person, we ourselves, are poised, ready for action when we see there's a possibility of being of some service, of alleviating the suffering of others, attending to the causes of suffering of others. It readies us, it makes us poised for it. And so I think there's tremendous merit in that once again, compassion is a quality of awareness. It's not simply the enactment in the world. So one may be very compassionate and sitting quietly in a cave because the heart is filled with compassion and it's ready to spring into action as soon as the need should be aroused. So I think, without further ado, maybe one final comment. Might this actually do some good out in the world, or are our minds really encased within the skull? You know, as if mind equals brain, and brain is definitely inside the skull. When we're doing this practice, is it entirely within the confines of our minds, which are hermetically sealed from the rest of the world? Is it, in other words, only an inside job? Or might there be some possibility that as we are cultivating compassion, that there is some subtle ripple effect out into the world, that it might actually in some way do some good? I've heard for years that here in Thailand, which is largely, but certainly not uniformly, a Buddhist country, but many Buddhists, that when calamity strikes, such as the tsunami or other natural catastrophes, I've heard it said, and I imagine it's true, that thousands and thousands of monks and nuns around the country will then gather together, that is not necessarily in the same place, but they will, how do we say, in their clusters, in their monasteries and so on, they will chant the Metta Sutta. They will engage in loving kindness practice, offering their prayers, their thoughts of loving kindness, their aspirations to heal where there is suffering and so forth. Do you know this, Malcolm? Is this, have you not heard that? You don't know whether it's true or not? Yeah, whether it's you, I'm not suggesting that this is an idyllic country and everything, you know, that all happens, but so I've heard. And one, the question here is, why would they do that? Is it just to make them feel good? You know, other people are suffering terribly, and obviously not. They're doing this in the sense that perhaps by their doing this, in reciting the sutra, the Buddhist discourse on loving kindness, meditating on loving kindness, that perhaps in some subtle way, this actually may do some good in the world. So does that happen? That, of course, is an empirical question. And so I think it's awaiting critical investigation to see. Okay? At the moment, I think we can just simply leave that and saying, possibly, perhaps it taps into such a deep dimension of consciousness and there's a healing power there that actually can do some good where the attention is directed. There are certainly many Buddhists, Christians, and others who believe that. But at the very least, we just come back to our own experience. Such practice really does have the power to transform our own hearts. And that is, after all, the primary focus. So we don't need to wait to see if there's any effect in the world before thinking maybe this is worthwhile. We can see, does this actually make the heart more open, empathetic, altruistic, compassionate? If so, then it works. Okay? So now, with no further ado, let's jump into the practice. We'll have one session. as you let your awareness slip into and fill the space of the body. Settle your body in its natural state and your respiration in its natural rhythm. And settle your mind in the present moment with a quality of ease, of release. Rest it in stillness and let your awareness illuminate the sensations of the in and out breath as you calm the body and gently subdue the obsessive flow of thoughts. And now let us arouse the mind in its more dynamic, creative, imaginative mode. We may conjoin this with the power of visualization. This, of course, is our choice. But as we now focus on the meditative cultivation of compassion, we may recall the Buddha's own allusion to different types of hedonic well-being. He highlighted the importance of these, in no way marginalizing, let alone disparaging them. There's the well-being, he commented, of having enough to eat. The well-being of being sufficiently clothed and having shelter. The well-being of having medical care when you need it. And finally, he commented on the well-being of being free of debt. here is a baseline. Obviously, we cannot have all of these at all times, but to really focus on spiritual practice, on Dharma, on the cultivation of our inner resources, of finding genuine happiness, there's no doubt it's an awful lot easier if you do have enough to eat, clothing, shelter, medical care, and don't have to worry about being in debt. It frees the mind up to really focus on the meaning of life. But as we well know, there are many human beings, let alone non-human beings, for whom these basic requisites are not met or marginally met. So this is where we draw on our powers of memory, of imagination. Attend now, if you will, to those many, many millions of people right now who are not only hungry, but have no means for the time being of satisfying their hunger. They are simply pained by hunger, and the pain does not go away. It so captures the mind and attention. It becomes so central to your experience. I'm hungry, and I have no food. Bring to mind such individuals. You may bring to mind regions of the globe that are struck by abject poverty. Due to natural calamity, due to civil war, due to despotic regimes, whatever the cause may be, hunger is still hunger. Attend to those who suffer from hunger, malnutrition. Attend to them closely. Let them become real in your mind's eye. And to the best of your ability, step out of your own confines, of your own personhood here, and imagine, as well as you can, what must this be like? Imagine being the other. Imagining your own Buddha nature, your own pristine awareness symbolically at your heart as before. Arouse with each in-breath. May you be free of the suffering of hunger. And with each out-breath, imagine food being supplied. Nutrition coming. With each in and out breath, imagine this pain and the anxiety, the fear that goes with it, abating, and the contentment of simply having enough to eat. Breathe in the suffering and dissolve it at your heart. breathe out the light, and imagine the light itself taking on the form of food and satisfying this basic human need. With each in-breath, arouse the yearning. May you be free of the suffering of hunger. With every out-breath, may you receive the nourishment you need. Just in one region of the globe, in Mongolia, this has been a brutal winter. Extraordinarily harsh climate, temperature down to 50 below, and so many of the livestock for the nomads frozen where they stood. The whole livelihood of families, countless families, wiped out with one brutal winter. And as they look upon the spring and the summer, no way to survive. Their livelihood is gone. Mothers and fathers wondering how. How to feed my children. Bring to mind those whose habitation, whose dwellings have been destroyed. Whether in Haiti, Chile, Kham in eastern Tibet, due to earthquakes. Other natural calamities. You had a home and now you have rubble. And it freezes at night. Or there's simply no place to live. How shall I take care of my family? Possessions gone, home gone, nothing. Breathe in the darkness of their dismay. Breathe out the light of hope. The light of help on its way. People willing to share their bounty with those in need, less fortunate. attend closely to those who suffer from physical or mental illness. And the care is not at hand. They can't afford it. It's far away. It's inaccessible. And so they only suffer with no hope in sight. They just see more suffering ahead. And then death. Especially those who suffer medically and have people who are dependent upon them, a spouse, children, relatives. How shall I care for my family if I am their sole provider and I cannot provide? With each in-breath, arouse the yearning, may your suffering for yourself, the suffering of those around you for you, may this suffering be eased, and may the medical care that you need, may it come. As you breathe out this light of loving kindness and compassion from your heart, imagine the medicine coming and the medical skill coming on the wings of compassion and altruism. And with each out-breath, imagine the suffering and the causes of suffering being calmed, soothed, and healed. Bring to mind those crushed under the burden of debt. Facing the imminent loss of all their possessions, their home going into foreclosure, other possessions being taken away, losing all basis of security, all hope for the good life. Facing the terrifying prospect of abject poverty, homeless, without work, and with no prospects. The feeling of simply being unneeded, of no value. Expand now the scope of your awareness in all directions, embracing all sentient beings, each one like ourselves, wishing for happiness and freedom from suffering. And with each in-breath, arouse the yearning, may each one be free of the outer causes of suffering. There are so many. And may each one encounter the outer conditions that are favorable for living a healthy and happy life. They are so important, these outer conditions as well. Breathe in, breathe out. And now release all appearances and objects to the mind, and release all aspirations, and for a moment let your awareness rest with no object, simply illuminating its own nature. Let's bring the session to a close. Oh, that's all. So, Danielle had two questions from yesterday. One is from another person here. I think Danielle mentioned that he translated it. May I say who gave the question? I know who it is. May I say who gave the question to Danielle? Oh, four or five people, or community. Okay, good. Well, I'm going to start there. There are two questions here. So the first question is really within the Buddhist context. And so if one is thinking outside the Buddhist context, this is not so important. But within the Buddhist context, very important. And I think it's just a wonderful question. So here it is. When contemplating the vastness of the Buddhist spiritual path and the fact that to achieve genuine and lasting transformation of our minds and for deep realizations to arise, it is necessary to work very intensely for a prolonged period of time. When recognizing all of that, one can get a bit dismayed or unmotivated, thinking, how can we approach this so unmotivated, just thinking, I can't do that. Maybe you have children, you have a job, you have commitments in the world, and you are not in a position to go off and just devote years and years off in our contemplative observatory. Maybe it's just not an option, and maybe for very good reasons. It's just not an option. Then all this talk about the, you know, developing shamatha and bodhicitta and so forth, it can, I sympathize with this very much, it can almost be like feeling like you're a starving person and then having somebody read the menu from a three-star restaurant. You know, a cordon bleu restaurant, and thinking, boy, that sounds good, but I can't even afford a piece of bread. So this is kind of just bumming me out. Because all the rich people are going into the restaurant and chowing down on these $300 meals, and I'm just trying to get a little pot of rice. So it kind of be dismaying and unmotivating. You're thinking, but I can't do this, and at least not in the foreseeable future. So how can we approach this from the modern standpoint in which we are immersed in responsibilities and mundane tasks? So there's a, what do they say, nice cop, bad cop, or something like that? Good cop, bad cop, good cop, bad cop. Okay, so first bad cop, let's get the bad cop out of the way. You're going to get the tough one here, right? And that is, how can we approach this from the modern standpoint in which we're immersed in responsibilities and mundane tasks? Well, if that's where you are, that's where your priorities are. I mean, that's the bottom line. This is the tough cop. If you're immersed in mundane concerns, if this is taking up all your time, that's because you value them over other things. It's just that simple. Now, if you do have small children, clearly that is the case, but generally those children got there not by accident. And so that was a priority. So if you've had priorities and you made choices on the basis of those priorities, quit complaining. Really. That was your choice. Nobody forced you to have babies or forced you to get a job or forced you to become this or that. You know, so you made your choice, live with it. People who become monks and nuns, they make a choice. That means no children for Mugi, no children for anybody, well, children unless you had children before. But once you become monk or nun, children time, making time is finished. That means, you know, you will not have a lot of the joys of the family life and being surrounded by your children, saying mommy and daddy and all that kind of business. Sacrifices are made, you know. Sacrifices are made. Why? Because you value something more. It's just that simple. So whether you formally take monastic ordination or whether you simply decide to become a yogi, that's because you prioritize that over other things. And to expect, sometimes I do get exasperated, I'm not feeling exasperated now, but when I've heard, and in fact I've seen His Holiness, so it's not even me, but even His Holiness, I saw Him break down into tears. And He buried His head in His lap, and He covered His head with His robe, and you saw His shoulders shaking with tears, with crying, before 5,000 people. It was in Los Angeles. I saw it. And what was the question that sent the Dalai Lama into paroxysms of grief? Somebody said, asked a question, Your Holiness, please tell us the fast and easy way to enlightenment. And he just broke down. He just broke down. I won't pretend to know what went on in his mind, but I can imagine my feeling, if that's your question, I'm leaving right now and I wish you well, but I'm heading off to my cave because I don't have any time for this crap. Anybody who thinks that to get a PhD in neuroscience takes 10 years, that's worth doing. To become a medical doctor, that's 6 years, that's worth doing. To become a professional musician, years of training, that's worth doing. But when it comes to enlightenment, make it quick and easy, please. Like we're a fast order chef. I just want to screw it. You know, screw it. I have no time for this. If that's the value you place on enlightenment, I have no time for you at all. I would rather spend the rest of my life in solitary meditation. It'll be much more worthwhile than wasting my time with people who have that attitude. So I'm imagining that's what I would feel. I won't project what he did, but we saw him. He was grieved. When he came out of, recovered himself, he came out and he just went zero. There is no fast and easy way. And then he said, okay, I'll give you an example. Milarepa, when he was accosting his own disciples, he said, there was no fast and easy way, but do you want the fast way to enlightenment? Because that's a good question. That's not a tearful question. That's not a stupid question. We want to be efficient. We want to just not flummox about and go up a lot of dead ends. Why should we waste our time? Life is short. And so Milarepa, when asked, what is the fast way to enlightenment, with no reference to easy, he turned around and he mooned the disciple. He pulled up his little garment and he showed him his butt. And he said, see my butt? It's calloused. It's calloused from sitting on my cushion 8, 12, 16, 18 hours a day. My butt gets calluses from meditating. That's the fast way to enlightenment. I think it was he who added, never let your meditation cushion get cold. And bear in mind, they're not talking about Phuket, where the only way to get your meditation cushion to get cold is to turn on the air conditioning. Now, he's talking about not letting your meditation cushion get cold when you're at 14,000 feet meditating in a cave. So there is a fast way to enlightenment. His Holiness was once asked years ago, not by me, but by some European. The European first made the comment, I think he was from Germany or Holland, I can't remember which. But he made the comment, first of all, he was bemoaning the fact that we're living in the Kali Yuga, the age of degeneration, the time when Dharma is degenerated, everything is degenerated. We're really going down the toilet, you know? And he said, in such degenerate era, this person made the complaint to His Holiness, oh, in such a degenerate era, it's so difficult to achieve enlightenment when everything is so degenerate. His Holiness listened to him. Very true. I've been told I do a terrible imitation of His Holiness, so maybe I should just stop. But he said, very true. But if you meditate like Milarepa today, you will achieve realization like Milarepa today. The world may be degenerate, you don't have to be degenerate. So these, some Tibetan lamas, I want to shake my finger at them when they say, oh, the time for realization is over. Oh, you can't do it. Just study and teach. Can't achieve realization anymore. What crap? When Buddhists say this, then we may just, well, you know, throw in our hand and give up. When even Buddhist teachers tell us this, that's terrible. What a disgrace. So sorry. But that's just giving up hope before you even try. And there are teachers like that. Shame on them. So, there's my first response. There's the tough cop response. Bad cop response. Is if you have other responsibilities and mundane tasks that are filling up all your time, that's because you prioritize them over Dharma. In which case, good luck. More importantly, and this is probably the last real question, okay, what's the real question? If we consider that from the Buddhist standpoint, there is very little chance that on our next life we'll have these types of close encounters with Dharma and opportunities such as this retreat, what can we do to try to be sure that from this moment on we will not be separated from the Triple Jewel, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, even if we do not achieve very significant progress in our practice in this lifetime? Now, there's a good question. How do we maintain continuity? And what are chances? Here we have, really right here, local, for 8 weeks. This is like the quintessence of a precious human. I mean, it would be nice to have the Dalai Lama here. It would be nice to have a really highly realized Lama. You don't have that good fortune. But at least I'm trying to pass on the teachings without distortion. So you got that much. Maybe that's a little bit better than nothing, right? But it would be great to have a truly realized master. Well, we don't have that. You don't have that fortune. But nevertheless, besides that, the environment, the sangha, the support, and so forth, it's hard to get much better than this. And by the way, the larger vision here, you notice that the name of this place is not called the Phuket International Academy Wallace Center. It's not called that. Go figure. You're supposed to laugh. Okay. It's not called the Wallace Institute because it has no vision of being the Wallace Institute. Klaus Heaven and I envisioned this place. He provided really everything that mattered. I'm here to catalyze it, to start it off. But what we're envisioning over the coming years is having really qualified teachers from multiple traditions, from the Zen tradition, Theravada tradition, multiple traditions within Tibetan Buddhism, as highly realized as we can get. And I will be here. My task will be to really try to maintain quality control. It will not just be anybody who wants to come to teach. But I will consult with my teachers and try to just get the very best we can, as if this is the Caltech of contemplative inquiry. The Caltech, the MIT, the Oxford, and the Harvard. Try to just make it as good as we can possibly make it, with the finest teachers we possibly can. including those with really profound realization. And I'm here just to facilitate that. And teach when there's nobody better. So that's what my job is. That's my job description. When there's nobody better, then, okay, Alan, fill in. So there we go. So, but the question is a very good one. That this is a transient period, this is 8 weeks, then it's finished. This life is a transient period, and it's finished. And of course, it's not guaranteed that everybody here is for an 8-week retreat. Because, of course, death could come at any time, right? So maybe some person might be a shorter retreat. And there's no guarantee that we'll live our fourscore and whatever, 10 years, 20 years, whatever. So what can we do to try to ensure that there is continuity from lifetime to lifetime, that these wonderful circumstances, meeting qualified teachers, having enough to eat, having internal requisites, having all the inner and outer conditions coming together, which is called a fully endowed, precious human rebirth with leisure and opportunity. Here we do have that. And how can we ensure, what can we do to try to ensure, to make the odds as good as possible, that in the next lifetime, frankly, what would really be optimal would be to have such a lifetime with all of those opportunity and the leisure, the freedom, that from this point until our enlightenment, we never have a gap of not one. That, to my mind, is a really good question. So now it's good cop. I'm very sympathetic to that question. I'm not sympathetic to people looking for a fast and easy way, or just say, oh, I don't have time to meditate. Can you give me a shorter technique? Can you make it shorter, shorter? All they're telling me is, I value so many other things more than Dharma. Can you make Dharma accommodate the very low priority I place upon it, because I'm really busy? And I say, well, then just be busy and don't waste my time. That's the bad cop again. Now we've got good cop. Back to good cop. There's a lovely story. I think it is, after all, my favorite story in all of Tibetan Buddhism. And I will say it briefly. But it is Domdomba, the chief disciple of Atisha, who was a layperson, coincidentally, and said to be a previous incarnation of the Dalai Lama. This teacher, Domdomba, encountered a person doing devotional practices, which are very, very manifest. You can see when a person is doing devotional practices. They're reciting mantra, they're circumambulating stupas, they're doing prostrations, they're uttering mandalas. I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, there's a lot going on. When you're doing devotional practices, you can see, oh, you're doing devotional practices. And so Dumdumba saw this fellow doing it, and he said, it's very good to do devotional practices, but it's even better to practice Dharma. And this person, I imagine, must have been quite nonplussed by that, because he was a good Tibetan Buddhist doing his whatever, circumambulating the stupa. But he took Domdomba, being a man of great substance, he took him seriously, and he put on his thinking cap, and then he decided, oh, I know what he gets. And he sat down and he really started studying Dharma. Really studying Dharma. Because after all, how do you practice Dharma if you don't first learn Dharma? Is this practicing Dharma? Is this really practicing Dharma? Reciting some mantra and going ho 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 and tipping sand all over the place or rice, is that really Dharma? How about doing the calisthenics of a full prostration? Is that really Dharma? It's good calisthenics, that's for sure. But is it Dharma? Walking around a stupa, is that really Dharma or is it simply exercise? Well, it's an open question. So the person said, oh, I get it. I have to study Dharma. So he's poring over the texts, poring, really learning Dharma. Domdomba came along to him and said, very good to study Dharma. Even better to practice Dharma. And obviously all kinds of people study Buddhist texts. Some make a living out of it. They're called scholars. They're called journalists. They're called anthropologists. They're called sociologists. They're called economists. There are all kinds of people who study sacred texts. They're linguists. There are all kinds of people. Does that mean just by studying some, reading some Buddhist text that you're practicing Dharma? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe you're just trying to get tenure. You know? And so the light went on, oh, maybe this isn't quite getting to the nucleus of it. And then, of course, then he came to what he was sure was the nucleus, and he sat down probably in the full Vairochana posture with the 7 points. And he was sitting impeccably, and now he's meditating. And he's probably meditating with one eye open, waiting for Domdomba to show up. So Domdomba can say, put her there. Finally you got it. You've been meditating. You actually applied for Phuket and you really got in. Good for you. Yeah. And so there he is meditating. And now he's certainly confident. This must be it. I'm not doing anything besides practicing Dharma. What's he doing? He may be visualizing the Buddha. Is visualizing the Buddha Dharma? Is visualizing the Buddha, is that Dharma? An artist might do it. Architect might do it. A person who just likes to visualize might do it. A person who's planning to blow up a Buddha image might do it. And getting in the target, oh, this is what they look like. Good, bring out the ammo. The mere fact that you're visualizing a Buddha image, the mere fact that you're following the breath, is that Dharma? That you're watching your mind, is that Dharma, really? Watching your mind? Blah, 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 blah. Watching a really bad movie in the mind? Is that Dharma? Or just resting in awareness of awareness? Oh, I'm aware. Oh. Wow. I thought I was dead, but I'm not. I'm still alive. Oh. Why is that Dharma? It's just being aware of awareness. It's just watching the mind. It's just watching tactile sensations, and they're not even very interesting. So what makes shamatha dharma? What makes vipassana dharma? If you're closely investigating how feelings arise, maybe you're just a psychologist, maybe you're just interested in feelings. And so Dhomdhumpa, of course, came along and he said, it's very good to meditate, but it's even better to practice dharma. So for those of you who are anticipating life after Phuket, L-A-P, maybe we can just call it L-A-P. Yeah. Or if we make it a P, it's just better, isn't it? Laugh. And the world will laugh with you. L-A-P-H. Phuket. In any case, as you're anticipating leaving here and wondering, but I have a lot of things to do, and maybe they're made very meaningful, then think what Dhomdhumpa said. It's very good to be in Phuket and watching your breath, but it's even better to practice Dharma. Maybe you are practicing Dharma here, but what determines whether you're practicing Dharma or not? The fellow was out of options. He had done devotional, he'd done the study trip, he'd done meditating, and he said, Dhomdhumpa, what do you mean when you say practice Dharma? And he said, give up attachment to this life and let your mind become Dharma. And that's the whole of the practice. Give up attachment to this life. One could be practicing here for 8 weeks and have it totally attachment to this life motivation. Could be. Why not? Motivation could be anything. And the fact that you're doing even the four immeasurables, is that necessarily Dharma? I'm not so sure. Following the breath, forget about it. It could be all kinds of things. Maybe you're just a breathing addict. I don't know. You know, sniffing. In any case. So give up attachment to this life does not mean give up enjoying anything. It doesn't mean giving up your family or your occupation or your money. It means giving up attachment to mundane concerns, doing whatever is necessary. But relinquish the grasping, relinquish the attachment, and do what's necessary. Do what is of value within the world. Raising happy, well-educated, well-balanced, virtuous children, that's meaningful. That's really meaningful. And doing so in a very loving and conscientious way. If one's running a business, producing a product that can really be of benefit to society, doing that in a conscientious way, charging a suitable amount, not an exorbitant amount for one's services, treating one's employees well, making sure that they're well looked after, and so forth. This is a good livelihood. And that may be an expression of Dharma. Running a business may be more of an expression of Dharma than sitting and watching your breath. Being a very loving parent may be more of an expression of Dharma than just watching thoughts come and go, right? And so it's giving up attachment, this self-centered attachment to the affairs of this life, of things like just my happiness lies in material acquisition, in fame, in sensual pleasures, in praise, in reputation, and so forth. Giving up all the mundane concerns, remaining in the world, and leading a meaningful life. Giving up attachment to this life, but that's one half the equation, and the other half equation is let your mind become Dharma. It's very easy, and I've heard this countless times, of people saying, oh, I used to be into meditation, and then I stopped, but I'm kind of getting interested again. I had some practice going really well for a while, but then I stopped, I got really busy, but now I'm interested again. Like an overcoat. It was cold a while back, and I put on the overcoat, but then it warmed up, and I took the overcoat off. But it's not getting a bit chilly. Where's that overcoat? Can you help me with a new overcoat? You know, like something, Dharma is just like a Band-Aid that gets us through the rough times. Well, if it's a Band-Aid in this lifetime, then imagine the future will be a Band-Aid once in a while, once in a blue moon, once when a star shines during the daytime, you might actually encounter Dharma in the future. If we treat it casually in this lifetime, there's no reason to expect that it's going to occur any more than casually in the future. It's just common sense. Whereas if one does one's utmost, whether living in solitude or raising a family of four with a full-time job and an extended family, if one lets one's mind become Dharma, not something you pick up and put down, but for every circumstance, Dharma for all seasons, Dharma in times of adversity, Dharma in times of felicity, Dharma in times of good health and bad health, financial security, financial precariousness, and so forth. Whatever comes up, having a rich enough understanding of Dharma, that there's always something to practice, there's always a way to immerse your mind, and then your speech and your body, in Dharma, so that you feel you're cloaked in Dharma. Dharma is your skin. Dharma is your vital organs. You're never separated from it. It's always there. It's always moving you. Moving into pure renunciation, pure bodhicitta, that your altruism, your four immeasurables, are your four constant companions, and they're guiding you through every encounter. The relaxation, the stability and vividness of your attention becoming more a mode of being. Mindfulness flowing through, conscientiousness flowing through the day. Then whether one is living an enormously busy day with many concerns or one is living a wonderfully simple lifestyle with very few concerns, in both cases it is possible to let your mind become Dharma. And insofar as you give up attachment to this life and let your mind become Dharma, then your life is richly meaningful. And if together with that, of course on the basis of ethics, of course on the basis of ethics, without ethics then there's nothing. Then give up all hope. With no ethics, give up all hope. There's no reason to hope. But if one is really doing one's best not to injure, not to inflict harm, being of service where possible, there's the ground. On that golden ground, if one gives up attachment to this life, lets one's mind becomes Dharma, and then, as Atisha counseled, and Domdoma, of course, passed on, in the morning, start with motivation. Bring to mind your loftiest ideals, your noblest aspirations, your heart's desire. What is your life all about? Because life happens day by day, moment by moment. Start every day. What is the meaning of all of this? What is your deepest aspiration? And let this be your prime mover throughout the course of the day, that you're motivated through the day with the motivation of Dharma, that is filtering, conditioning every, as much as possible, every moment. At the end of the day, then looking back, so there is a finite period from waking to about to fall asleep, looking back at the end of the day, and then dedicating the merit, whatever benefit, whatever virtue, whatever good there is from this day. And then now is the time for aspiration. Once again, to bring to mind what are your highest aspirations. And one of them, I've not given you any script for this loving kindness practice of, you know, internally or dedication of merit. I've not given any script at all, quite deliberately. But what are some of the common, really classic prayers? By the merit of today's practice, by the merit of today's life, of this day's life, of the virtue in this life, in all lifetimes may I never be separated from qualified teachers, from conducive environment, from all the supportive conditions for continuing my practice of Dharma. You may bring to mind very specific teachers with whom you have a very strong connection, and feeling, this person, and I have said this to multiple of my own teachers, I say that quite candidly. I remember just speaking with Gyatso Rinpoche just recently. He's quite old, he's quite frail, and over the last 20 years especially, been of such extraordinary kindness, and the guidance he's provided for me, if I could be the richest man in the world or have his guidance for the last 20 years, that's the easiest decision I've made. His guidance, no question, not even a second thought, so much more valuable than anything that money could buy. And of course he gave it for free. So I met with him a couple of months ago, and I simply said, I mean, it's a simple thing, but emotion does come up. But, yeah, I think you know. If I say it, I'm probably just going to start crying. But I think you know. So I won't say. You can figure it out. But that aspiration never to be separated from truly authentic teachers. that in each lifetime they may catch us with a hook of their compassion. I really think there's no greater gift than that. And so, if we do our best, it's over now. If we do our best, though, live an ethical life, give up attachment to this life, let your mind become Dharma, make connections with authentic teachers, authentic guides who can really lead you further along the path, maintain pure relationship there, and then make the aspirations, the dedication of merit, in this and in all future life, may I encounter such qualified teachers, including this one and this one and this one. You can be specific. You can even ask them, please catch me with the hook of your compassion. Then, it's like being a farmer. You're sowing all the causes, then you can expect the harvest. Then, it happens. And you don't need to achieve shamatha in this lifetime. Frankly, I'm now going to say it's not that big a deal. It's not that big a deal to achieve shamatha in this lifetime. If you achieve it, you might just sit in it and wallow in it for the rest of your life. Oh, isn't it nice to be blissful, luminous, and non-conceptual? Oh, and just kind of bliss out for the rest of your life, which means it's kind of like a waste of time. You know, you just got caught. You just got bogged down in substrate consciousness. You know, so it may not be that meaningful to achieve shamatha. It can be terrifically meaningful, and we know how. Use it for something really worthwhile. But if you don't achieve shamatha in this lifetime, not that big a deal. If you do achieve it and do something very meaningful with it, that's a very big deal. But to maintain the continuity from this point through the course of the life, every day, giving up attachment to this life, letting your mind become Dharma, dedicating the merit, that may this continue, may that continue to ripen, whether it's one lifetime, five lifetimes, 1,000 lifetimes, however, that every time I may reconnect with Dharma. If you really have confidence and trust and conviction and commitment to this path. If you don't, then find a path. It doesn't have to be this one. But if you find really the Buddhist path speaks to your heart, speaks to your mind, and really earns your deep trust, then you're a Buddhist. I didn't say what you have to believe in, but the Buddhist definition is one who really has that trust, that commitment. This is the path. The Buddha is a teacher I trust. The Dharma is a path I trust. The Sangha is a community I trust. I entrust myself, then you're a Buddhist. And being a Buddhist then draws you back. So that's how. So Shantideva addresses this point when he, in his mind, he addresses the enormity of achieving the perfect enlightenment of a Buddha and how many lifetimes that may entail. You know? And he was quailing at the how many lifetimes might that be. But then he bolsters his confidence, he arouses, he inspires himself once again, and then he reminds himself, I'm paraphrasing here, but it's pretty close. He said, but if I've developed bodhicitta, and I'm coming back as a bodhisattva, then every one of those lifetimes is going to be wonderfully meaningful, and I'll just go from joy to greater joy to greater joy to greater joy to the joy of a Buddha. So whether it takes one lifetime or a million lifetimes, where exactly is the problem? Because every lifetime is meaningful, and it's proceeding along the path. So, that's the good cop, that this is certainly feasible. And so the highest priority is to maintain continuity, the integrity of the practice, pure connection with authentic teachers, so you have someone to come connect with, because it does happen, doesn't it, that some people may have a very, very sincere aspiration to follow Dharma, and then not find any teacher. It happens. All they wind up with is books. That's kind of sad. All you have is a book. The book never talks back. The book never gives you any personal guidance. And so, creating connection with authentic teacher, qualified teacher, very important. So, I hope that suffices. That's an answer to that question.